This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Hello, I'm Andrew McGregor, presenter of CD Review on BBC Radio 3, and you're about to hear an edited edition of Building a Library, which every week compares available recordings of a particular piece of music. This week, Piers Burton Page has been savouring a 20th century masterpiece for violin and orchestra, Béla Bartók's Second Violin Concerto. Piers reckons it's been recorded over 30 times, and at least 20 recordings are still in circulation, including the world premiere from almost 70 years ago. But for many, Bartók's Second Violin Concerto will always be associated with one violinist, Yehudi Menuhin.
If I were a Taoist, which I'm not, I'd be tempted to define Bartók's Second Violin Concerto very much in terms of yin and yang. It's a work of wide, even wild, extremes. Turbulence versus dream, earthiness versus mysticism, danger versus serenity, sophistication versus folk roots. And any successful performance has to reflect those extremes. The yin and yang aspect may well have been what appealed to Yehudi Menuhin in this concerto. He was, after all, famously fascinated by Eastern philosophy. That was Menuhin, recorded in Bartók's Second Violin Concerto by EMI in 1965. Yehudi Menuhin, of course, had shares in Bartók. Famously, in America during the war, they met, and Menuhin not only commissioned one of Bartók's very last works, the Sonata for Solo Violin, he also studied and performed this concerto many times. And there are at least half a dozen versions on which Menuhin features, all still around, though some are more available than others. They range from a 1947 live concert with Ernest Ansemet and the Suisse Romande, via the 1953 studio recording for EMI, now sounding rather dim but with Furtwängler, a surprisingly successful choice as conductor, to a 1957 live concert with Fritz Reiner in Chicago. And then there are Menuhin's three studio recordings with Antal Doráty, including that last recording, the EMI from 1965, by which time I had the faint feeling that Menuhin was just slightly on autopilot. Compare what we heard just now with this, where every note seems more alive. Listen to the many subtleties of inflection in the solo line. A hint of portamento here, a fractional rubato there, lovely shades of colour and intensity. A master hand at work. That's Anna-Sophie Mutter, recorded, slightly larger than life, in 1991 by Deutsche Grammophon, with the Boston Symphony Orchestra under Seiji Ozawa. For For many years, it was believed there was only one Bartók violin concerto, this one, until the resurrection in the late 1950s of a much earlier work, written in 1907 and 8, when Bartók was in love with the violinist Steffi Geier. He gave her the manuscript, but though they remained friends after their affair had ended, that work stayed unperformed and hidden. What we now call the second concerto wasn't begun until 1936, during a wonderfully productive period that also saw the birth of such masterpieces as the Music for Strings, Percussion and Celesta, and the Sonata for Two Pianos and Percussion. But Bartók had been no stranger to the violin between whiles. There were a pair of violin and piano sonatas for Jeli Daranyi in the 1920s, and a pair of shorter rhapsodies for Joseph Sigeti. The score of the concerto actually bears the dates August 1937 to December 31st, 1938. A period in European history, therefore, including the Anschluss, Munich, and Hitler's annexation of the Sudetenland. Bartók's letters show his increasing despair over these events in Europe. But I don't think you'd sense that for a moment from the work itself. Here's the opening again, one final time. That, miraculously, is the concerto's world premiere. Bartók's second violin concerto was first performed on the 23rd of March 1939 in Amsterdam, with Willem Mengelberg conducting the Concertgebouw Orchestra. The soloist, also the dedicatee of the work, and the man who'd asked Bartók to write it 3 years earlier, was Zoltán Székely. The live performance was recorded by Dutch radio, and the acetates survived the war to live again on LP and CD. Intriguingly, Bartók himself wasn't actually present. He had a concert date back in Budapest, though he had rehearsed intensively with the soloist, but not with Mengelberg, earlier in the month. The sound, even when cleaned up, is still fairly grim, and it's not recommendable as a definitive account, not just because of the sound, but also for a catastrophic wrong entry in the strings soon after the start of the finale, when half of them come in a bar early. But it is nevertheless an indispensable document, particularly for the light it sheds on matters of tempo. Székely's is still the shortest account of any on record, at just over 34 minutes. And that brings us right up against a classic Bartók problem, that of the plethora of timings and metronome marks he put into his scores, often in the process sowing more confusion than light. Open this one, and problems begin even before the first note of music. Duration, it says, 32 minutes. Well, that ought to read at least 33 and a half, because Bartók unaccountably overlooked one of his many intermediate timings in the first movement when he came to add them up. This first movement, by the way, has 36 separate metronome markings on top of all those intermediate timings. Well, we'll have to come back to this topic, but we might start by asking now, what are they for? The answer is actually buried away in the violin and piano version of this very work. A note by Bartók to the effect that the timings and the metronome marks aren't mandatory, they're there for guidance. Which of course raises the question, how free is the interpreter to disregard them?
Thank you.
That's from a little later in the first movement, as seen by the most recent interpreter on CD of Bartok's concerto, the young French violinist Laurent Corsia, on the Naive label with Sakari Oramo conducting the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. And it's very much a young man's performance, fast and furious a lot of the time, impulsive even, but also ready to be expansive. I did feel in that passage, and once or twice elsewhere, that he hustles the music a bit. And yet he's pretty close to Bartok's metronome mark of crotchet equals 132, or circa 132, actually. Bartok doesn't usually offer that amount of leeway. I'm very drawn to Laurent Corsia's version, as I am to a much older version, still available, that's virtually passed into legend. The Israeli violinist Ivri Gitlis was 32 when he recorded the concerto, and it's a performance bursting with drama and energy, fire, even passion. That's Ivri Gitlis in 1954 and in mono, now on Vox. He was accompanied by the Vienna Symphony Orchestra and Yasha Horenstein. Though I use the word accompanied with some hesitation, because quite a lot of it is simply inaudible in that Viennese bathroom. Who was it who said the devil is in the detail? Well, in this of all concertos, masking the details is a serious crime. Particularly so in the slow movement, which is everywhere full of the most delicate touches of orchestration, but it's true in many other places too. I hesitate to use the word impressionistic, but let's not forget that at this relatively late stage in his career, Bartok had a wealth of orchestral experience behind him, to be found in such diverse scores as Bluebeard's Castle, The Wooden Prince, or The Miraculous Mandarin, as well as most of his other concertos. Recording quality does matter, if it means that you can't hear half of what's going on in the accompaniment, or, as in too many cases, the balance between soloist and orchestra is distressingly distorted, mostly, I have to say, in favour of the soloist. Kyung-hwa Chung has recorded Béla Bartók's second concerto twice. There's a much-admired recording on Decca that's been steadily available for over 30 years now, and a later version on EMI. This is absolutely her piece. She makes everything sound so easy, and yet she can be capricious where it matters too. Here's a moment halfway through the first movement, where the first theme returns, but an octave up, then slows right down, only to be re-energised. And I love Kyung-hwa Chung's sensitive use of portamento here. Kyung-hwa Chung and the London Philharmonic under Sir George Sholty from 1976, on a good value Decca All Bartok twofer. But be warned, the sound isn't really state-of-the-art. There's not much bloom round the orchestra, and things like the pizzicatos snapping off the fingerboard at the end of the movement are rather tame. And I've still got her EMI remake up my sleeve. Just to show you, though, that I'm not against historic recordings on principle, let's go back to Yehudi Menuhin, this time in Dallas in 1946, so just 3 years after he'd first taken up this concerto. The huge, almost outrageous cadenza at the end of Movement 1 ought, I think, to be cataclysmic. No point in making it sound like 2 minutes of unaccompanied Bach. It's music that's surely trying to burst its bounds. And you couldn't call this tame. That's only the halfway point. Menuhin, very powerful on an RCA reissue of his now historic first recording, with Dorati in Dallas. You can really sense what a magnificent performer Menuhin must have been in his prime. But when you get to the orchestral tutti's, it's not such an impressive experience. Quite what the definition of a historical recording is these days is a moot point, a 40-year cut-off, perhaps. Let's turn to the slow middle movement. I wouldn't quite call it the emotional heart of the work, because I'm not sure that the concerto lends itself to analysis in quite such romantic terms. It's a little more calculated than that. But all the same, it's a real challenge musically. When Zoltán Székely first asked for a concerto, Bartók offered him just a theme and variations, for which he'd even already jotted down a few ideas. After some discussion and debate, Székely got what he wanted, a work on the more conventional three-movement model. But the original theme and variations became the concerto's middle movement, and it remains Bartók's principal mature example of variation form. Here's its cunningly crafted and expressive theme. That's Anna-Sophie Mutter in Boston, finding plenty of poetry right at the outset. But just as I warm to her, I also warm to a very different account of Bartók's second concerto, on Berlin Classics this time. Swifter, more concerned with the wood than the trees. Excellently balanced, but not short on poetry either. Here is the Austrian violinist Thomas Zehetmeier in the first of the six variations, semiquavers from the soloist set against timpani and lower strings. Tomasz Czehetmeyer, recorded in Budapest with the Hungarian orchestra and conductor. Ivan Fischer conducting the orchestra that he founded, the Budapest Festival. Definitely a version to keep an eye on. And here's Variation 2, mainly a dialogue between the soloist, the harp and celesta. So, tricky for the balance engineer. Christian Tetzlaff, on a Virgin Classics budget issue, recorded back in 1991, is excellent and excellently accompanied by Michael Geelan. A young Christian Tetzlaff and the London Philharmonic under Michael Geelan. A lovely moment of lyrical respite. Delicate, too. In the next variation, a study in gritty double stopping, Tetzlaff is just a trifle laboured for my taste, anyway. I'll pass over that and go on to Variation 4, which is an absolute miracle of invention. Out of his theme, Bartók conjures something fantastic. I'm not quite sure how to define it. It might be something out of his insect world or out of one of his night musics. But personally, I think it's also grown out of his endless listening to and transcribing of folk musicians, and that it ought to come over something like a sotto voce Romanian doina, a keening gypsy rhapsody. Well, there are plenty of mesmerising versions of that wonderful lento. That splendidly idiomatic and sonorous version was from a Supraphon box of four CDs of all Bartók's music for the violin, featuring another Hungarian violinist long associated with Bartók, Andrei Gertler. In fact, the booklet has a very charming photograph of the two of them together, taken in Brussels, to where Gertler had recently fled before the arrival of the Nazis. The year was 1938, so Bartók would have been dreaming up this concerto at that very moment. It was, though, another 27 years before Gertler recorded the work, in Prague, with the Czech Philharmonic under Karel Ancel. It's in stereo, as you heard. I'd characterise it as a very lively, forthright performance all round. It feels almost live, though I don't think it is. I'm going to cast, not a cold eye, but actually a rather inquisitive one, over a clutch of deleted versions. A, because there's treasure trove here too, and B, because the web these days seems to have drastically altered the notions of availability and deletions anyway, so you might just still come across one or two of them somewhere. If you have tears, prepare to shed them now, over, for instance, Itzhak Perlman's very fine recording from 1973, and over no fewer than three, all made in the same year, 1990, from Pinkas Zuckerman, Midori and Dmitri Sitkovetsky. I've heard all three, and each had something special to offer. Happily just restored to circulation, though, is this version. That's the last variation in Bartok's middle movement, Variation 6, realised magnificently by Kyung-hwa Chung, not on Decca with Sir George Shelty this time, but with Simon Rattle and the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra on her 1990 remake for EMI. It's an astonishing performance, not least for the almost tangible sense of partnership between soloist and conductor. You can hear Chung bending her ears back as Rattle teases out every last nuance in the accompaniment. Those snapping pizzicatos have real bite now. And then she matches him with countless flashes of imagination and insight of her own. Her first movement had a magnificent mix of blistering intensity and infinite tenderness, that yin and yang I wanted right at the start. And in this variation movement, Kyung-hwa Chung is equally responsive. Bartok ends the slow movement by simply repeating his theme, but now, magically, it's an octave higher. And it's an affecting poetic idea. I don't think, though, that it should send you to sleep. That was Gil Shaham on DG, with Boulez and the Chicago Symphony. A highly regarded performance for its sheer clarity when it first appeared 10 years ago. It's still available as a download, but I think it lacks the last ounce or more of fire and energy and electricity. The expansiveness rather surprised me. And that takes us back to the thorny problem of Béla Bartók's own timings and metronome marks. It's easy enough to say that they don't matter all that much, to argue that they're only guidelines, and that a performer's musical instincts should take precedence. Despite the well-known cases of Bartók's own mistakes in this area, and the Allegro Barbaro and the Concerto for Orchestra are two notorious examples, all the anecdotal evidence suggests that the composer was neither careless nor stupid. The violinist Chandor Vague recalled him sitting in a corner during rehearsals, measuring speeds and times and noting them all down. The fact that every single recorded performance of this concerto exceeds Bartók's own adjusted timing of 33.5 minutes by several further minutes must give us pause for thought. Have our performing and listening habits actually changed? Are we missing a dimension in this concerto? The dimension of feverish intensity, perhaps? I'd love to hear a state-of-the-art version that takes Bartók at face value from someone who's not tackled it on record yet. Mr. Kennedy or Ms. Little, are you listening? And so to the finale. It's a kind of reversioning of the first movement, with elements of the first movement recurring, but this time more as dance than as song, and not always in the first movement sequence either. And it has 47 separate metronome indications. Who's left in the ring? Still several names I've not touched on yet, and I'm sorry if your own favourite doesn't get a mention, let alone an illustration. At the start of the finale, it's a fast one in a bar, and there's little by way of variation in tempo. But does that mean absolutely strict tempo? Well, with Bartók, that's always a good question, as I keep on suggesting.
Thank you.
That's a brave version of Bartok's second violin concerto on a small German independent label, Ars Produktion. The soloist, Nora Chastain, is the granddaughter of the American composer Roy Harris, and she was also a protégé of Yehudi Menuhin's. But I'm afraid all that's not enough, really, to commend it. Compare what you've just heard with this. That was Jerzy Pałk, recorded in 1997 by Naxos with the Polish National Radio Symphony Orchestra. The freedom and expressiveness, not to mention the much cleaner recording, put him in a different league from that earlier German version. Jerzy Pałk is a native Hungarian. You'll occasionally hear it said, mostly by Hungarians, that it takes a Hungarian to play Hungarian music, and especially the music of Bartok. Something to do with the rhythms and stresses of the spoken language working their way into a composer's musical subconscious, and something to do with the vocabulary shared with Hungarian folk music, in which, of course, Bartok was a profound scholar. Well, this is dangerous ground. Occasionally, some part of me wants to believe that Elgar is best played by native performers, but it can't be true, can it? So, just before striking the argument out of court, let's consider some of the other Hungarian violinists in this concerto. On that country's own label, Hungaraton, in addition to the work's first soloist, Zoltán Székely, there's a 1970 recording by Dénes Kovács and the Budapest Symphony, still sounding fairly decent, but now buried within an 8-CD set, forming part of Hungaraton's Bartok Complete Edition. And more recently, Vilmos Szobody and the Hungarian State Symphony Orchestra, dry and rather bland, and not really recommendable. André Gertler I've already mentioned, and his is a wonderfully consistent performance throughout. This finale is full of frenetic, even splenetic outbursts, the violin part plastered with markings such as conspirito or strepitoso, or, as here, ruvido, rough. And listen out for the clarinet burbling away right at the end of the extract, which, by the way, has both a Hungarian soloist and conductor. It's surprising on how many recordings you can't hear those clarinet triplets clearly. Yet, as I mentioned early on, the accompaniment to this concerto has so many magic touches like that. That was Tibor Varga with the Berlin Phil under Ferenc Fritschai, recorded by Deutsche Grammophon in 1951. Historic and mono, and the soloist's fast vibrato elsewhere a bit off-putting. But, unsurprisingly, this was for long a cult version on LP, and it's still around. Who is there among state-of-the-art versions to match that kind of fierce, driven quality? Here's an Austro-Hungarian challenger. ¶¶ Thomas Zehetmeyer on a full-price Berlin Classics release. Technically superb and a master of the varying moods of this piece. This is a really splendid interpretation, in its way very refined. The last four bars of the violin part in that extract are marked first with warmth and then sonorously. Zehetmeyer doesn't ignore them, but he doesn't exaggerate them either, which isn't always the case in other versions. Once again, Ivan Fischer and the Budapest Festival Orchestra know absolutely what they're about in support. As we approach the final pages, another teasing little conundrum rears its head. Which version? At the existence of the work's only begetter, Zoltán Székely, Bartók changed the ending. Originally, and rather bravely, it ended with a final flourish on the orchestra alone, with the soloist having shot his final bolt and now just a bystander. But Székely evidently felt this was slightly anticlimactic, and so Bartók eventually consented to supply a rather more conventional finale. This later and more showy alternative is what appears on most recordings, but not all. Both versions of the ending are printed in the score, and my view is that the composer's first instinct actually had a lot to be said for it. Well, we can judge for ourselves. Mark Kaplan, Christian Tetzlaff, Victoria Mulliver, without saying so, and Pinkas Zukerman are four versions that all opt for the original. And Zukerman, with Leonard Slatkin on RCA, actually offers two complete alternative versions of the finale. But maddeningly, that all-round excellent version is another one off the radar, temporarily at least. So here are some final pyrotechnics from Victoria Mulliver, with the conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen getting full value out of Bartók's rasping trumpet glissandi from the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Mulliver and Salonen on Philips, giving us Bartók's original orchestra-only ending. The Mulliver version, by the way, has always been near the top of my list. It's never less than astonishingly clean and accurate, it's very poised and very responsive, and in good sound. And it never really got me excited. Perhaps that's my fault. Critics are only human after all. To sum up, then. My preferred single-disc budget price version, for its all-round qualities, would be George Pauk on Naxos. But be warned, my overall winner also comes at budget price, though this time in a 3-CD box. I've been much taken with the sheer rollercoaster ride offered by Laurent Corsia on Naïve, a live performance, by the way, but I'm not sure that I'd want to live with it always. No, the choice for me ultimately lies between three great but very different artists. Thomas Zehetmeyer on Berlin Classics and Anna-Sophie Mutter on DG are like, well, low-fat spread versus dairy butter. But which is better for you? Zehetmeyer is more cleanly recorded and balanced. The all-important accompaniment under Ivan Fischer has greater focus. And the soloist himself is at all times supremely in control. Tempi are faster than many others, but, crucially, they all interrelate, and they convince me. Indeed, Tsehet Meyer's taut performance reminded me a bit of Zoltán Székely's, who gave the world premiere we heard at the start, and that's meant as a compliment. On the Mutter recording, I'm frustrated at not hearing some of the orchestral detail, and she's recorded in rather more glamorising close-up. But, and it's a big but, I do think she has the edge over Tsehet Meyer in terms of imagination and variety. Happily, however, we can enjoy the best of both worlds on the third of my trio, which is therefore my Building a Library nomination. Kyung-hwa Chung is simply mesmerising throughout, technically jaw-dropping, but with an espressivo that's literally fantastic. She, more than anyone, best reflects that yin and yang that I wanted at the outset, and she also happens to have the best accompaniment of any. So here are Kyung-hwa Chung and the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra under Simon Rattle, on fire at the end of Bartok's wonderful second concerto.
Darkness and Light and Fiery Passion from Kyung-hwa Chung in Bartok's Violin Concerto No. 2 with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra conducted by Simon Rattle. And it's just been reissued by EMI at budget price. It's Piers Burton Page's overall recommendation for the work in this week's Building a Library, which you heard in an edited edition. You'll find full details of the recording on the CD Review website and on CFAX BBC One page 651. Next week, Building a Library on Poulenc's Gloria, which you can also hear if you join me, Andrew McGregor, for CD Review. Saturday mornings from 9 till 12:15 on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 92 FM, online and on digital radio.